Welcome to 411 Child, a podcast for those who have children or teenagers, who work with children or teenagers, or has ever been a child or a teenager. In each episode, you'll hear a conversation between Beth, who is a longtime child and adolescent psychologist and college professor, and Jennifer, who's a longtime teacher and parent. We'll explore the many different topics related to child and adolescent development, learning, and provide strategies that you can use to help your child to navigate through those more difficult times in their lives. We'll also explain these developmental issues using scientific principles and scientific studies to relate to the child and adolescent development. Then we'll provide very practical tips and strategies that can be used to help them in their life problems. Our conversation is very different than those that you typically hear, because oftentimes psychologists and teachers have different points of view and understand psychology from different perspectives. So each week we strive to bring research to practice and practice to research. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Attention Center of Tampa Bay. Hi, I'm Beth.
Hi, I'm Jennifer.
And welcome to Adolescence Part 2, The Private Lives of Teens.
Because it was too big for just one podcast.
Boy, was it ever. And in fact, I think we're going to continue this into our third podcast on adolescence.
So if you keep listening for the next few years, we'll have Adolescence Part 110.
Before we get going, though, I wanted to ask you about Halloween. What are your kids going to dress up as?
Oh, well, the littlest one's Tinkerbell, and she knows how she wants her hair, and she's got sparkly shoes.
Yeah,
and
she's
Aiden,
been telling me about it.
I know. Aiden has been counting down Halloween for like 3 months. He's going to be a wizard because he plays Wizard 101. So
right.
Yeah, it's all about the wizards and Harry Potter and all that. And then Rose is a genie. I think mostly just because she liked the costume. It was all about what the costume looked like on that one. So.
And I know your kids have been really excited about their costumes
yes.
for a long time because we started talking about this probably 2 months ago.
It has been, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I sew them, so they have to know ahead of time. We don't just go to the store and buy them, so.
Well, also, your kids love dress-up because
oh, yes.
remember when I came over and your kids put on all their different costumes and
oh, yeah.
they come out and show me?
Uh-huh.
Why do you think kids like dressing up so much?
Well, I know why mine like to dress up so much, because they can act like somebody completely different than who they are. And, yeah, they get to be a princess or, I mean, heck, Rose has come out in Incredible Hulk costumes before from Aiden's, yeah. So, I mean, they're just, yeah, they enjoy that aspect of being something completely different. And then they put on shows. So
yes.
then they're putting on, you know, plays and dances and, you know, they dress all up. And they have wigs and shoes and, yeah.
Yeah. I know your children love to,
yes.
to dress up. And they're not just your children. I mean, dressing up is a bad thing or that, you know, trying out different identities is a bad thing. And in fact, we start when we're young children and dress up. And a lot of times in dress-up, kids want to be adults, and they want
yes.
to, in all of the costumes that you've made for your children, there are heroes, and
yes.
they are magical powers,
yes.
right?
Yes.
I think just about every costume that your children have that
yeah.
you've made, either it's a superhero,
yes,
mm-hmm. right? Doesn't he have a Spider-Man?
Oh, he has
Spider-Man, yeah,
and Hulk. Yeah, and the Hulk,
right.
and, yeah.
And all of your girls' costumes are all sort of, you know,
yeah, they're
Tinkerbell.
Fantasy,
and,
yeah, time,
yeah.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
all have powers.
Princesses and, yeah.
Genies.
Yes.
And,
mm-hmm.
and what's neat is that that's actually a required part of our psychosocial development.
Okay.
And that's what we're going to talk about today is this private life of teens really starts back in dressing up, like, for Halloween.
Okay.
I don't know, this is going to bring us back to our college school days, but there was a wonderful psychologist named Eric Erickson who many, many moons ago created a psychosocial development theory saying that we create our sense of self from birth. And we go through many, many different stages. We're not going to go through any of them today except for one,
yeah.
which is what most adolescents do. And it's this self-identity versus role confusion.
Makes sense.
So his idea was, as we develop, we either develop and rise to our ego crisis And when we talk about, I know, ego crisis, not like a midlife crisis or anything, which, by the way, that's a myth, but anyway.
Oh, good, so he doesn't get a really fast car someday.
Not really, no.
Okay, good.
No, he'll stay with that big old
good to
van
know.
Of his, yeah. My husband's midlife crisis was getting married to me, so.
Oh.
That was, yeah.
Well, that was a good thing.
I think so.
All right.
So, but the self-identity starts from childhood, and either we face the crisis of the developmental period, or we don't. And if we don't, then we suffer problems going forward. In adolescent years, this self-identity versus role confusion, or identity diffusion, they call it sometimes, it means that a child just has no idea where he fits in.
Okay.
And
then are there some people that just stay there for long periods of time? Because I know some adults that don't seem to know what their role is.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So they never resolved
the crisis.
Of figuring out who they really are.
Okay.
Do you remember back in college where people wanted to find themselves? And,
yes.
Yeah. And
yeah.
And
I'm going to drop out of school and be Tinkerbell at Disney World because I want to find myself. That was our valedictorian. Yeah.
And that really is just like saying, hi, I haven't figured out in the self-identity versus role confusion. I'm on the role confusion side. Thank
okay.
you. And developing this private life that teenagers have is a critical part of this. And it's so confusing to parents because on the one hand, you want to let your child develop his or her own sense of self. On the other hand, you really want to guide it to the point of controlling it, to the point of shutting it down.
This is the kind of person you're going to be.
Yeah, and how many parents out there have these ideas of what they want their children to be?
Yes.
I want my child to be a doctor. I want
right.
my child to be a plumber. Mm-hmm. I want my child to be a school teacher.
Right.
I want my child to be a good Christian man. I
yes.
want my child to whatever. It doesn't matter. Parents have ideas and goals for their children. All very loving, all good to have. But it's probably stronger if you help your child develop his or her own goals that fit the person that he's becoming.
Yeah.
But instead of talking about a whole bunch of hypotheticals today, we actually got a question.
Yay!
Yay! So, here.
Okay, let me in. I'll read it for us. Let's see. Oh, my goodness, this is a good
question.
Dear
Beth and Jen.
Wow. I know that my son, who is 15, needs privacy. However, how much is too much? I suspect that he is doing things of which my husband and I would disapprove, but do not want to invade his privacy. So how do we handle this?
Wow.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. Let me ask you. Let's all go back to those teenage years.
Yeah.
Yeah. We go back to our 12, 13, 14-year-old years. Many of us were not trying to hide behaviors from our parents just yet, although many years ago when cigarettes were more accessible, a lot of kids were smoking 12,
yes.
13, 14 years old.
Yes, I know one of those.
And yeah, me too. I was one of them.
Ah!
And, well, I mean, consider, I was growing up in
yeah.
Maryland and
yeah.
you know, right in the Washington, D.C. area, and that's tobacco-growing.
Yeah,
country.
Absolutely.
And this was in the 1970s. And yeah, and at a time when everyone was smoking, every parent.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's true. And the movies and the restaurants.
Right.
And the movie theaters.
Right. And we had freestanding cigarette machines everywhere.
Yes.
Absolutely everywhere.
Yeah.
And cigarettes at
yeah.
the time were a dollar a pack.
Whoa.
I think they're on $6 or $7.
Okay.
I don't know. I haven't smoked in a
They're
six. Many,
I just
many,
bought
many
some
decades,
father-in-law.
But,
yes.
But for pack cigarettes.
Yes.
Insane.
I did the same thing. I went, what?
That's insane. And, you know, we kids didn't have to hide much. It wasn't hard to hide that behavior
yeah.
of smoking because we could buy cigarettes easily. We just had to, on the way to school.
Yeah.
There was a freestanding kiosk
yeah.
where every child stopped and bought cigarettes.
Yeah.
And we went off to
Absolutely.
School.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When we were 12, 13, 14, there was a lot more freedom in our neighborhoods. Kids ran wild.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we didn't worry about the things that we worry about today. And we had woods right behind our house, so, you know, everybody went down there to smoke. And I remember the very first time I smoked. I have to, this is horrible. I was 12, and I was still worried about getting in trouble. I'm 44 years old. Anyway. Sorry, Mom.
Sorry, Mom.
I was 12 years old, and it was neighborhood kids, of course, a little bit older than me, and I ran with an older pack all the time.
Yeah.
And we went down to the woods to, you know, go talk or whatever, and so everybody started handing cigarettes around. I thought, oh, no, I really don't want to do this. I thought it was disgusting, and both my parents smoked, and we were one of those families where, yours was this way, too. We got in the station wagon, door windows up, parents smoking, smoking.
Now he's like this crazy Nazi anti-smoker now. So.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, yeah. It's obnoxious, but yes.
So, and, you know, we're driving along, and everybody was like this. The windows were closed tightly, and all the smoke was circulating around the big station wagons, and, you know, our big family cars would open, and clouds of smoke would come, and children would come flying out. So, you know, all of our lungs, I think, were damaged anyway. So this one day, the cigarettes were being passed around, and I took one like everyone else because, well, peer pressure, you know, and dopey not thinking. But here was the funny thing. I was already thinking how to not do this, and as they were passing the lighter around, I just let it go past me like three times, and finally somebody said, oh, you don't know how to light it. Took my cigarette, lit it for me, handed it to me. I spent the rest of the day blowing out. My lips like blew out. I just was not. That is, oh, let's do smoke circles and all those things. And I did not. I just kept blowing out. I thought, okay, I'm fine. And I thought, wow, this really is disgusting.
It's gross.
Yeah. And so, of course, I didn't smoke again until I was probably in high school.
Okay.
And in high school,
I can't imagine you with a cigarette.
I know it's so not me. But this is even funnier. Then I get into high school. Our high school had two smoking lounges. We had three smoking lounges. We had one for teachers.
Okay.
We had one indoors for students and one outdoors for students and teachers. Now, if you had a favorite teacher who smoked, and you wanted to hang out with that teacher, you kind of had to go to the smoking lounge.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And
we must have had a big high school. See, our smoking area was around the block.
They
would walk around the block.
Yeah. Right. You know, and so people stood outside and smoked. Yeah. And at 16, we were allowed to buy cigarettes. So we had cigarette machines in our school.
Huh. Oh, wow. Really?
Yes. And this was in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is one of the best school systems in the country. So it wasn't even, you know, this wasn't some backwoods, you know,
place.
But my point is this, is that it was so much a part of the culture that we kids hid it from our parents, most of us.
Yeah.
But we could do the behavior openly in public.
Right.
And I used to come home. This is really bad. And I actually knew I would get in enormous trouble if I smoked at home.
Okay.
But I did anyway. Unfortunately, I had become addicted.
Yeah.
And so I would smoke out of my own, I had my own bathroom, so I would smoke out of my own bathroom. And like any good addict, stupid 16-year-old, I put the cigarette butts in the toilet until the day it backed up and cigarette, and apparently while I was at school, cigarette butts just kept coming out of my mom. I came home from school. I can't even begin to tell you how much trouble I was in.
Oh my gosh, that's funny.
Yeah. And I stopped smoking after that.
I would imagine.
My point in telling this story, though, is that back then there were societal pressures of something to do openly but to hide from your parents. Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Geez, I wonder what that is now.
Yeah, right? I wonder what that is now. Social networking and emailing and same thing as it was back then, sex also.
Yes.
You know, the question here was, as I recall, how much is too much privacy?
Yeah.
And the thing is that with young children, we start by playing dress up. And it's all open, so there's no hiding.
Yeah.
But we're creating a fantasy world.
Yeah.
And it's encouraged by our parents.
Yeah.
We're read to.
Yes.
We're asked to read, you know, recreational books. Mm-hmm. We go to art and music classes. We are asked to create things in class.
Yeah.
And we begin to make this fantasy world. As we shift into pre-adolescence, it becomes more of a private life.
Okay.
And it becomes internal inside our heads.
Yeah.
But it's not quite there yet in 12, 13, 14 years old because we're now dividing our behaviors between what's acceptable at home and what's acceptable by our peers and our peer groups. So we're beginning to make that shift. In that time, as you recall, we talked about last week, 14-year-olds have fully functioning risk-taking systems, saying, hey, baby, go do what feels good. But you have the prefrontal cortex saying, duh. Supposed to be saying, wait a minute,
there's consequences.
let's plan this behavior and so forth. That's why we have a lot of teen pregnancies that occur at 13, 14 years old. And not as many that occur at 16 and 17.
That makes
more
sense.
In the 13, 14-year-old range because of that. Yeah.
That's frightening.
It is frightening. But this is that shift. Now, young adult literature books, which I talked about last week, are all designed to help kids create an inner fantasy world, private life.
Right.
The young adult books that we give out to our clients have minimal adults in the stories. If the adults are in the stories, they're dumb. They are. The kids always
have adults are dumb. You think about
well,
it.
That is true.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, you're right. Teenage books, you're right. They're peripheral or mom and dad don't know what they're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah.
The adults play a very minimal role. And the child plays a very powerful role. Look at The Wimpy Kid.
Yeah.
The Diary of the Wimpy Kid. That's one that's not, doesn't seem to be a dark and sinister
no.
at all, but the Wimpy Kid has power.
Yeah.
And it is because they need to feel powerful in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So during this time, what they're doing is comparing their sense of self that their family gave them.
Okay.
To their sense of self that their friends are giving them. And that their teachers give them.
Yeah.
And that's why teachers are so incredibly critical to the development of
sure.
a child's
yeah.
sense of self. And here's another example of privacy. And I don't remember, you and I were in a Catholic school together, so this couldn't happen except after school. And I know you and I saw this, but when I worked in public schools, in the junior high, in particularly junior high, middle school, we used to see this a lot. Kids would come to school looking like children. I mean, they like pre-adolescents.
Right.
And go into the bathrooms.
Yeah.
Take off the clothes that they came to school in. Put on makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Put on these clothes.
Yeah.
Put colors in their hair.
Oh, yeah.
And go to school.
Yeah.
Go to their classes.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly since I was a band director, so I saw them differently than their other teachers because I spent a lot of after-school time with them, too.
Well, if you think about it, we had the skirt rolling up stuff.
Right.
So even though they were wearing uniforms, we had the rolling of the skirts.
That's right. And a lot of times we would see them change to go to after-school things, remember? And they looked very different.
Oh,
then.
Very, yeah.
Right, than they did in school.
Yeah.
But the kids who came to school changed clothes or changed their appearance, and then at the end of the day, we'd go back in. We used to call them the Clark Kent kids.
Yeah.
Would go back to, what would be acceptable going home.
Yeah.
Now, that's one of those cases where we did not give that up to parents, unless there was a major concern.
That's
because
true. Yeah.
we were monitoring the changes that they made in school.
Yeah.
No harm, no foul.
No, exactly.
However, she asked about her son who's 15 years old. And this is usually 14, 15, 16 is when parents become most concerned.
Yes.
Because 12 and 13-year-olds are still sort of talking to their parents.
Sure.
Or at least they're getting in trouble. Because they're not good at hiding things yet.
Yes.
And so they usually get in overt trouble.
Yeah.
But once they get to be 14, 15, sometimes 16, parents become very concerned. Why? Well, they stop talking to their parents.
Mm-hmm.
They become, they become cranky.
Oh, yeah.
And that's an euphemism because I really mean they become obnoxious and... And smart aleck.
Oh God, the look that they give you. I wonder if that's like DNA, something genetic that they have that. They all have that look. Oh, you know.
Well, you did too.
About.
In fact,
oh,
I saw it. So that was a very good one.
Or the eye roll.
Or the eye roll. Oh, and the sighing. My sister is the best sigher on the planet.
Yeah, you could hear like 3 blocks away.
Oh, she was. Oh, no, geez. She had an entire language
of sighs. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this next part, she said, well, I suspect that he's doing things that my husband and I would disapprove of. Of course he is.
Yeah.
That's exactly what
teenagers are. And that's why he's hiding it. Yeah. Because he
doesn't
disapprove. Yeah.
But you know what?
That could also be something as simple as you want him to play football, but he doesn't. He wants to join a band. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it could be something even like that. He could be doing something not even bad behind your back, but it could be something that he thinks mom and dad will disapprove of.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that they're carrying into their pre-adolescence and then adolescence the idea of what mom and dad, they think that mom and dad wants,
right,
without knowing that their parents have the ability to change their
right
idea of the child. Problem is, a lot of parents don't. They don't get there fast enough.
Yes.
And so parents still have this clear-cut idea of how they want the child to be without being willing to change their idea.
Right.
And that the child senses that and doesn't talk to the parents.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to try on all kinds of different activities and all kinds of different identities and different friends.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what kids hide are this. They usually hide a friend or friends that they
makes
think
sense
that their parents will not approve of.
Right.
They will hide, and it depends on where in the country you were. Please remember, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, where politics were sports. And so for us kids, we were trying on different political identities that we knew for sure our parents would not like.
See, I grew up in Fort Myers, so we tipped cows.
The other thing, too, is that a lot of times the things that children are hiding are their secret language that they have with their friends.
Yeah.
And they don't want, they're afraid if their parents find out too much about what they're doing,
mm-hmm,
that they'll tell other parents.
Oh,
and
sure,
then they will have social consequences because of that. It's more that than anything else.
Well,
what parents have a hard time understanding is that if you have instilled really good values and morals in your child, then you really don't need to worry. Are they going to make mistakes? Oh, goodness, yes.
Yes.
But it doesn't matter. They're going to make mistakes anyway.
Yeah.
It's how they recover from them and how the family recovers.
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of parents who become very worried at this time are thinking back to the things that they did.
Sure.
And are assuming that their own children will do the same and worse.
We had this issue in the family. I won't tell you who in case they ever listen to this, but we had this issue in the family, a stepchild, and with a mom that was a little racy at one time in her life, and the stepfather was very concerned that then his children, who he then had with her, were going to be the same. And he was worried about trying to protect that his stepchild and not wanting her to end up like her mother, who would go to a bar and have a drink. And I mean, nothing, it wasn't anything terribly horrible, but it was his perspective that he wanted to protect them, and now has gone to the total other end of the spectrum where they can't breathe in the house without permission. I mean, it's, you know, can I get a drink? Like in their own house. It's like, so we've gone to the other end of the spectrum of wanting to protect them to the point that they make no decisions at all on their own.
And that's more dangerous
or
just as dangerous as allowing them to make all the decisions.
Yes. And there's got to be a happy medium. I mean, let them make some of their own mistakes and hope that they make them in a small ways instead of the big ones.
It's part of how parents accept those mistakes that teaches the child how to accept his or her own mistakes.
Yes.
If a parent is explosive and harsh when a child makes a mistake, and it is out of fear. See, here's the thing. Parents love, this is what I have to counsel adolescents in all the time. Parents love their children deeper than any adolescent can ever understand.
Yeah.
The bond between a parent and a child, no matter how dysfunctional the relationship may be in the moment, or one or the other might be, the bond is so deep and so primal that the parent reacts in anger because the parent's afraid.
That's true, yeah.
The parent is afraid.
That's very true, because I know sometimes I do that, and I know that, and I have to pull back and say, I'm getting angry for just no reason. And but sometimes it's already out there. I've already yelled, I've already done stupid things, and then I have to back up and I go, oh, why did I do that? He was just, you know, doing something stupid. But I saw, I was afraid. See, when they got into the smacking, beating each other fight, you know, I reacted with anger, and I shouldn't have.
Right.
I should have been that peaceful, that separated them.
Yeah, but
and
be careful of the should-haves, because,
I know.
You know.
I do need to be careful of that.
Yeah. Because that gets us in trouble, too. I mean, we act the way we do. The thing
because
is to stop
do.
And then explain.
Yeah.
But okay. You know, but here's an example of, and again, I'll take one from my own life. Here's an example of how a parent's values and teaching actually do guide an adolescent through their lives in the very difficult times. I'll, again, roll back to my own teenage time. I was in high school, and I think it was a sophomore. And I went to a gigantic high school, just gigantic. And we had what's called open lunch.
Okay.
Which meant that everyone could leave campus if they wanted to. We all had cars, and I don't know. What else. So we all had cars. And
I went to a Catholic high school. I mean, we were like locked down, like in a shackle to a wall.
Well, I was in public high school because of my need for music.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was taking a zillion music classes. But anyway, so we had open lunch, and in open lunch, we were allowed to leave campus, and there was no checking out or anything like that. It was basically door opened, and everyone had to be back for their next class. Well, a lot of kids didn't leave, not every day, but a lot of us did. And it could have happened. So I was a sophomore. My friends and I walked across the street to a pizza joint, and you know, ordered our pizza and waited for it before we went back to school. And some older guys came in. And I don't know. Seniors and knew one of my friends who was older, and so they came and sat in our booth with us, and you know, we're all laughing and playing around. So, and all of a sudden, one of the guys opens his hand, and there are a bunch of pills in there.
Oh,
now, again,
no.
This is 79.
God, this seems like an ABC after school special,
doesn't
it?
And well, let me tell you the whole story. You know, opened his hand and there's some pills in there. Now, there was no way I was going to do drugs. There just was not. I was a nerd in that I had to do well in school.
And
my parents would kill me and all of that. And I just wasn't interested. But again, you know, passing around, and I refused.
Yeah.
I openly refused.
Yeah.
I said, no, thank you. You know, then it was again, no, thank you. Then the guy pretends to be interested in me while I was 16 years old. It's like, oh, okay. So I took it, and I was like, okay, now how am I not going to, again, I'm battling now between social pressure and my parents' values and teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, well, how can I not do this? And I don't want to do this. Well, then it was, well, okay, I'm trying to remember what we had been taught in that. Remember those drug education classes? I'm trying to remember what it was that we were supposed to do. I was like, well, you know what? That's all done. I'll just do this. I will pretend to take it, and that'll be the end of that.
Yeah.
And they won't know because we're going back to school,
right. And
I can go out and, you know.
Yeah.
So I did. I pretended to take it. No, they called me on it. They saw I didn't take it. So, so I thought, okay, I'll put it under my tongue, and then I will go to the bathroom, and I'll just spit it out. So I did that. I put it under my tongue, and as I am telling them I'm about to go to the bathroom, I sneezed. And I swallowed it.
Oh, no!
And this was, when we came back to school, I had two more periods.
I can hear that awful, like, 70s music in the background.
It was just
shit.
Like that. No, it was truly just like that. I even went to the bathroom, and I'm not the kind of, anyway, I couldn't make it come back. And I just, the whole thing, it was like,
geez.
Oh, I'm going to have to, and it didn't take very long for me to feel, by the way, it was speed. Me on speed. Can you imagine? Like, that's going to be the worst. I'm so hyped up anyway.
That's
the worst drug I should ever take. So here I am, 16 years old, thank goodness I didn't drive that day. Completely inexperienced in any of that. I'd never taken drugs. I hadn't. And I hadn't even smoked pot. So I, you know, here I am.
I'm starting to cry.
I know, on speed in my Spanish class. And I was really by myself because I was in, like, Spanish, I don't know, 100 or something. Like, I was in an upper level, a very upper level class, and I was so annoyed because I couldn't pay attention. Bell rang, and then my favorite class of the day, and it was Modern World History, and I was so mad at myself because at that point my heart was racing, I was sweating, worse than me on coffee. So, anyway, I went home and slept it off, and believe it or not, I actually talked to my parents about it.
Yeah.
And I was not punished, but we talked about it, and that was the last time that I did Because to me, it was the experience of it. I didn't like it, and it didn't serve me well in my life, and it didn't mesh with what I had been taught by my parents.
Yeah.
And that's an example of how it can work.
Yeah.
It's an example of how we kids back then, were able to, in our private lives, try to manage a very difficult situation. Mm-hmm. So I still haven't really answered the question. I know I'm taking a lot of time to do it, but I think it's important that we sort of explore all of these that happen. When you were in high school, did you know anyone who had an eating disorder or?
I could say that I had suspected a few did. Because they were really, you'd see them and they'd eat lettuce for lunch and then they'd go to the bathroom. And yeah, I knew a few that we suspected. Well, we had very small high school. We only had 400 kids in our high school, so it was very small. But yeah, I would say there was a few.
That's, eating disorders is another private life. It's a place where girls who don't feel real good about themselves going into adolescence find a community. They find a group of people. And people might wonder, well, how's that happen? Well, it's in the eating disorder culture.
Yeah.
Girls teach each other how to basically have an eating disorder.
Yes.
And there are what's called pro-Anna sites on the internet. And they're very hard. And Anna is anorexia.
Yes.
And so what happens is that these girls set up these websites and send out private emails to each other in code about how to get to the website where they then brag about how much weight they've lost. And they tell each other how to do it. They support each other in this weight loss. They're aware of the fact that they're nothing but bums, and many of them know that they're dying. And yet they continue because it's such a tight culture that welcomes them in, that helps them feel good about themselves, although it is, of course, a very sick and dangerous culture.
Yeah.
And
they support each other. And I've read, about those websites, and it was frightening when I was reading about that. I was thinking, will we allow these kids to be on websites that promoted speed use or drunk driving or something? But
these
are prolific,
Know.
Well, these girls, it's frightening.
There are those sites too. Arrowid.com, Arowid.com, which I will put in the podcast notes.
Yeah.
Is a pro drug using website. And when I worked in substance abuse, we used to go to that site all the time because it was forever being updated by drug users, so it helped us to understand
what was going on. Interesting.
But it's harder to get to the eating disorder community because these girls are so good at hiding. But it gets to the point where they think they're good at hiding, and then that's when they're actually close to being dead. And one of the problems is that they don't, even if you send them off for treatment, they don't get better because they miss the culture.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you think about that with anything, the smoking, you miss being around the smokers or the drug addicts or the whatever it is in high school.
Well, I always count on you for the positive. What about the positive culture?
Sorry. Band? No.
Drama.
Well, yeah, that's what's funny is I was like the antithesis of the teenagers we're talking about. And I don't know why it is, because my sister was very much what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Very private. Didn't talk to her parents. My parents would get in the car once she had it and leave. And I think that then I was 12. So she was 16. I was 12, 13. So now I'm at home by myself with my parents. So I almost had to talk to them. We went out to eat. We went, I take my parents on vacation with me still, We were very close. So I was always I'm not going to smoke. I've never smoked. I've never done drugs.
No.
I wasn't a drinker when I was a teenager. I didn't drive fast. None of that stuff. Didn't have none of that when I was a teenager. But I was involved with this nice little clique of friends that also believed all that.
Right.
We were kind of Catholic, Catholic kids. So none of us drank, none of us did the drugs, and we were all in drama, chorus, yearbook, all very nerdy sort of activities in high school. But and I found my niche, and that's where I stayed. And they still are. They're my friends on Facebook. I married one of them, although he was kind of on the fringe there, but yeah.
And I was one of these kids who needed a lot of the risk. I had a very strong risk very strong. Go do this. It's fun.
See, I did not,
However, I had such strong family values.
Yeah.
And like you, came from the same kind of background.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were there in my face all the time.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know,
well,
I ended up taking that risk-taking. My parents are smart about this.
Yeah.
The risk-taking in very healthy ways. And so I was... in fact, I'm going to go in a few minutes to talk about what some of the things that parents can do, but my parents were good about getting me into, like, horseback riding.
Yeah.
I come from a horseback riding family.
Okay.
And we had, I dressage was fine, which is where you make the horse walk, trot, and, like, move
uh-huh.
in a certain way. Move in a certain way. Which I found to be quite boring. I was much more daring, so
okay.
my mom had me doing... jumping classes. And
oh,
so
okay.
I was jumping, and I was jumping
okay.
high and fast, and
yeah.
and getting hurt, and loving
yeah.
every moment of it. And
yeah.
I needed to be on the back of a horse because I needed that rush. Taking
okay.
that rush, I learned to put that into the music.
Mm-hmm.
And being a musician
okay.
is a big risk, particularly since I then went on to do a lot of stage work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then became a band director. And all of
yeah.
that is risky in that
yes.
I could make public mistakes at any time.
Absolutely.
But it was a much more
yeah.
healthy way to deal with
yeah.
risk-taking. And
yeah.
I had a very good, solid core group of friends. We
yeah.
were very tight, and we supported each other. We went through, you know,
yeah.
our teenage years. I can honestly say that I actually look back upon my teenage years, and I don't regret anything, actually. I had such good friends.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun in high school.
I
yeah.
did, too.
I wouldn't want to relive it. But I had a lot of fun in high school.
Yeah.
But I think my risk-taking more came from saying no. Like, my risk-taking came from saying, no, I'm not going to smoke. No.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that, because I got that same rush because I was saying no to my peers. And I got a rush off of that. You know, the blood pressure would go up, you know, and sometimes I got ridiculed, and sometimes I lost friends. But I just didn't believe in doing all of that. It was just so ingrained, I think.
Yes.
I had a very strong moral code as a
yes.
teenager, which is pretty funny, but I had a very strong moral code.
It's not funny because most teens actually do have a very
yeah, it's
strong
standing
moral
up for it. That's so hard.
It's hard, and yet parents don't know how often their children
actually do it.
And
mm-hmm.
that's the thing. I have so
yeah.
many parents who ask me all the time, have I kept my child too innocent? Have I protected him too much? And my answer is no,
no.
You haven't. At some point, I mean, to the extreme, I talk to those parents, but most of them
yeah.
are not. It's in their passing of their
yeah.
morals and their values that they have to then believe and let go a little
yes.
bit that their children will
yeah.
use them. They have to practice.
Yeah.
That's what teenage is about.
Yeah.
It's practicing to be an adult. The other place that you were risky was that you did a lot of reading, didn't you?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, and
lots
so the
yeah.
risk-taking can also occur in our heads.
Yeah.
And some of our greatest thinkers
yeah.
were not our greatest doers.
That's true.
And, yeah,
yeah.
and, you know.
When I always read, well, my sister was 3 years older than me, so she'd finish a book and I'd read it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I remember going into my freshman year of high school, and Mr. Redmond, he's retired now, but he would do this pop culture list every week, and he'd put 10 things on the board, phrases, and then we'd talk about them, just, you know, kind of, because some of them were like Big Brother from
mm-hmm.
1984, and that's the one that sticks out in my head, because he put Big Brother on there, nobody knew what he was talking about, we were all freshmen, and I'm like, yeah, that's from George Orwell's 1984, and I
right.
went on this whole litany, and he's looking at me, but my sister had read it like 2 years ago.
Right.
So I read it in seventh grade.
Right.
You know, and so So, yeah, I was always ahead on that, you know, reading because, yeah, I just, whatever was laying around the house, I'd read. Yeah.
I, in my family,
yeah.
we were always reading way ahead. We
yeah.
were in adult books very young.
Yeah.
But again, my parents are trying to manage our risk
right.
in how we acted. And
yeah.
they were very good about each
yeah.
knowing each child and knowing what each
yeah.
one of us needed, I think.
But, yeah, we read everything. It didn't matter if it was political, if it was, you know, scary books, mystery books, even the romance type novels and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no censorship in my family.
Censored. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Again, this all goes back to what our listener had asked us,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to actually answer it now. So she says, however, how much is too much
yeah.
as far as giving, knowing how much privacy
how much,
to give
yeah.
to a child? Here's how much privacy we should give to our children. They're allowed to have their own thoughts. and they need to have their own thoughts.
Yeah.
And we should not be hounding them constantly to tell us what they're thinking. The harder we push, the harder they pull back.
Yeah.
And they're designed to do that. Mm-hmm. Their job is to pull back.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be smarter, because we are smarter.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of pushing, what we need to do is simply be. And we have to do, it's almost reverse psychology in that you don't ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I even suggested that in our last podcast. To know how much is too much. It is not too much to go into a child's room and let the child know that you will be going through the room and that there is no privacy in a child's room.
Yeah.
It is important that they know that from a young age.
Yeah.
I'll talk in a moment about how to do that in a way that doesn't pick a fight with the child.
Were you in my house yesterday?
So, no.
What is this bowl of fruit doing in here?
No, but a lot of people ask me that. So on the side of hiding things in a room or keeping, you know, staying out of a teenager's room, I advise going into the teenager's room, not while the child's there. Don't conduct an open search with the child in the room. That's an invitation for
the absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't advise doing it when the child's at school either. Again, I'll talk about it in a second, but because then you're hiding.
Yeah.
See, parents don't understand that they have their hiding behaviors.
Yes.
And their hiding behaviors actually cause big problems for the teenagers and their hiding behaviors.
Absolutely.
The idea is to stop hiding behaviors in the house.
Right.
And, well, with the exception of, and I'll just say it, masturbation. Please let them do that alone and not to
and
confront them.
No.
And not to confront
them.
That's something to allow them to do.
I have this to look forward to.
Sorry. For me, it's a commonplace discussion with parents.
Poor things.
But, well, yeah. Now, what you don't want to keep private are things like who are your kids' friends?
Yeah.
What do they have in their rooms? What do they have in their backpacks? What are they wearing to school? Those are all non-privacy issues. You should know what they're doing. Now, if you find out that your child's going to school and changing clothes and, you know, someone mentions this to you, that's a discussion you might want to have with whoever's raising the child with you about how you want to handle it, because it depends on what they're doing.
Yeah.
If a child is dressing in goth, you might be concerned. If they're dressing as something that disturbs you or is against your family's cores and values, you might want, you probably want to have that discussion.
Yeah.
If your child is simply putting on a little bit of makeup and that's a constant battle in your house, you decide. As I always say, you have to pick your battles wisely.
Yeah, that's true.
However, if you start finding things in a kid's room, like drug paraphernalia or condoms or something, and then discussions have to be had.
But yay for the condoms!
And discussions have to be had. Well, that depends on the family's values.
That's very true.
Core values. So,
well, it was interesting. I told you earlier that I was watching a show on heroin use yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is a girl was a teenager. And if you went into her room, if you just went into her room, it just it was all on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was hidden in her room. She had the little balloons that the heroin comes in. She had them, stored in this little bowl on the dresser. So there's, hundreds of little balloons there. And then in one drawer, she had all the tinfoil that she used when she was using the drug.
Right.
And it was just, the whole drawer was full of tinfoil, burned tinfoil.
Yeah.
And then if you just looked around the room on all the surfaces of the doorknobs and everything, there was the residue.
Right.
The black residue. And I was thinking, wow, do those parents, never walk in her room?
Well, no.
But
and
they mustn't.
No, well, not...
Or ignoring it, I'm not sure.
Probably a couple of things. And here's the other thing for parents. You go into your child's room and you may not know what you find.
Yes.
And that it's more that than anything else.
I was thinking, a little bit of education, I think those parents would have known exactly what they were seeing.
I've had parents bring me things from their kids' room and ask what it is.
What is
it? Genuinely ask. And when I was a school counselor at where you and I used to work, I actually sent out a substance on behalf of the parent to a chemical lab to make sure it was what we thought it was.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you find things you don't know what it is, find out.
Yes.
Find out what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what kids will count on. They'll count that we don't know
Yes.
And we don't. Many of us don't understand there is a brand new culture out there that was not around when we were teenagers. And it doesn't matter if you were a teenager in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s or the 50s.
Yeah.
Your kids have a different world.
Absolutely.
Just like we had
yeah.
a different world than my
we
parents did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, again, you know, how do we handle all of this? Well, here are my very specific things that parents can do. All right, so the first thing is, I said, you know, this open room policy. What I have found to work time and time again for families is this. When a teenager is showing hiding behaviors,
yeah.
the entire family should do this. Because this is not picking on anyone. It's simply
right.
now a new family activity.
Yeah.
You don't have a big talk to your child about not hiding things and about how you don't trust them and all that, because you're inviting an argument and weeks of torture between
yes.
the two of you.
Yes.
And so instead of closing the communication doors, open them up and do this. Pick one day a week, one afternoon, one evening, one Saturday. I usually say Saturday mornings. All family members, including two-year-olds, must engage in a family cleaning swarm.
Yeah.
And what you do
yeah.
is you swarm.
The look of swarm.
From, it's exactly what it is. You swarm from one room to another, and each person has a specific job.
Yeah.
You know, like dusting or vacuuming or, you know, whatever. It depends on
yeah.
the room. And each one of you goes through the room, each room, all together. Now, I know parents are like, I don't want kids going through my room. That's fine. The parents' room is allowed to be off. However, I'll share with you, the whole cleaning is really nice.
Yes.
So, you know,
yeah.
just make
that
sure that the rules are that no drawers are opened in your room
yeah.
or whatever it is, because
yeah.
you know, adults are allowed to have adult rooms. Anyway, but teenagers are not.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you do is open drawers and rearrange clothes. And so you're
yeah.
folding clothes, or you can bring your laundry.
Mm-hmm.
With families, too, it's like if you can arrange it, have your laundry to put
laundry
away
day,
on that,
that
day.
Yeah.
yeah. And then
yeah.
so everyone goes to help put away laundry as well. Now, this means that you have open access to everything in the room. And the only thing you really don't have access to is probably your desk drawers, if they have them.
Yeah.
And so that you can check, you know, that
yeah.
I guess you can check on your own once
yeah.
you're at school. But I do not believe
yeah.
and I would tell you that most people who work with adolescents would tell you that it needs to be open. Go in the rooms and know it's in there, but don't
yeah.
do it in a way where you're creating a battle between you
right.
and your child.
Right.
You're both hiding.
Yes.
They hide. It's a game of hide and seek.
Yeah.
You go in and they hide and all sorts of things. Now, what happens if you find stuff? Well, it depends on what you find. Obviously, if it's anything that's against your family's
mm-hmm.
core values, you do have to have a discussion about.
Yeah.
If it is in boys' rooms, racing magazines under a mattress, I would say leave it. Just leave
yeah.
it. It's fine. It's not going to,
yeah.
unless, again, this is against your family's moral and religious beliefs.
Right. Right.
But for the mainstream people, better that than you don't want to,
yes.
yeah. And you want to have a discussion with them if there's a male figure around about, you know, just to make sure they understand everything.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So that sort of is one way to do it without.
I love that idea because, yeah, it's, that means it's our house.
Exactly.
It's not your room, our room. It's our house. I
well,
love that idea.
The argument that parents get into is this. It's my house because I pay for it, which is true. Let's all right now just be really open. We work hard. We pay our mortgages. They are our houses.
Yes.
And because we are the adults. However, you're right.
We all live there.
From a child's perspective,
yeah, it's
why not
house.
Let them think it's their house too? Because then they're less likely to want to hide things. They're
right.
less likely to want to do things that are unacceptable in
yeah.
the house.
Yeah, I love that idea.
When you are gone, think about this. This sets them up for many years of caring about what the house looks like
right.
because they know they have to clean it.
Yes.
The instances of teen parties that occur when parents are gone are far lower in families that do my swarming cleaning
interesting.
Than those that don't.
Well, sure, because then they have to clean it all up.
That's exactly
that makes
they
absolute
know,
sense.
They know.
They know
they
have
to.
To.
Yes. And
yeah.
they know the amount of work that goes into cleaning the
yeah.
house. On top of the fact that they know that things can't be hidden. So I suggest that if, let's see, so that's pretty good. Another one is, and this takes some work, and I've had parents tell me that this is impossible, and I then suggest that they simply need to rework their activities and their thinking. But one adult in the family should take each child separately to his or her activity at least once a week. I told you earlier that we were a horseback riding family. It was one of the things that we all did. My sisters and I all rode, and so did my mom, and we all rode. And so the one thing that my mom did in my teenage years when I really was very volatile because I was one of these smart kids who had opinions about everything, backed up by nothing, and
Boy, that sums it up right there.
and I even knew it at the time, but I didn't want to admit it. The one thing that my mom did that I think was very smart was throw me in her car once a week. And actually, towards the end, I started riding a lot, so she actually took me twice.
Okay.
But put me in the car, and we drove to Potomac from where we lived, where the riding center was where I did my training. And so we drove there, and we had easily half hour to 40-minute drive ride one way.
Yeah.
And she picked me up at school where I had band rehearsal.
Okay.
I'd change into my riding clothes, and then we'd go together half an hour, 40 minutes. Well, we had some very tense car rides. I'm not sure my mother had many stories that I don't remember.
Boy.
But she was very smart about the way she did it, because
yeah.
instead of fighting with me, she taught me things. And in the teaching, I learned a lot, and I never felt compelled that I had to tell her things about my life. And I ended up offering them. Because I was one of those smart, very difficult children. And in my high school years, I was. And as I got ready to learn how to drive, she started playing a game with me to train my attention, believe it or not. We would drive and down a particular part of the road, and my mother would say, "What did you just see? Tell me every road sign you just saw."
Okay.
And at the beginning, I was terrible at it.
Yeah.
And towards the end, I started getting extremely good at it. My mother has this amazing ability to just see everything and take it in at once.
Yeah.
And she taught me that. And she taught me that that was required for driving.
Oh, interesting.
What she was really doing.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure my mom realizes this. Although she's really wise in this sense. She was training me for life.
Yeah.
She was teaching me to look at every single aspect of what's in front of me, all the stimuli that's in front of me, and to analyze it.
Yeah.
And that helped me through my teenage years. It wasn't until I became a psychologist that I realized how powerful those
lessons were in the car as you just drove around.
Right.
Yeah.
And she was like, "Yeah, it's for driving."
Yeah.
But I realized later it wasn't just for driving. And, you know, and then she was with me, but the neat thing was that she actually stayed and watched. I usually rode for about an hour.
Yeah.
She would stay right in the ring instead of sitting on her car. And even though she'd bring her book and read, she's still, I'd look up and there'd be times she'd be watching me. And as a teenager, my mom was very smart because as a teenager, I needed that attention.
Yes.
But there was no way I was going to
ask for it. Now.
And there was no way I was going to explain that I needed it or I was going to show that I was needy in any manner.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd get in the car and she'd make corrections, not in a mean way, but she'd make corrections for me that my teacher missed.
Okay.
And she would,
you knew she was watching.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And she can tell you stories about jumps where, you know, I went head first over and she thought I was going to get clobbered by a horse and so forth. And, but the idea was that we had a shared experience in my teenage years.
Yeah.
We had a lot when I was a younger child, but in my teenage years.
Yeah.
For those of you who have children who have many, many different activities, and even those who have cars and are driving themselves places, make a point. If you can't do it once a week, at least twice a month.
Yeah.
Get in the car with your child, by him or herself, and do not grill the child. Instead, teach something.
Yeah.
Or talk about something that, you know, you're both interested in.
Yeah.
Or talk about a movie that you saw as a family. Or just don't do that. And the more that you do it, the more that the child will want to open up to you.
And they'll get used to it, too. So it's not going to be out of the ordinary. It's just a part of their lives. And
right.
Mom's there for that half hour a week. I know she is. And we're in the car. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and what parents find is that kids start to save up things to talk to their parents about.
And that half hour, that's exactly what I would have done. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Another one is when a child won't talk. And I mean won't talk at all. When you have an oyster child, tight-lipped, you know, kid who says sort of all the time, or I don't know.
Yeah.
And it drives parents just bananas. Because, you know, underneath of those, there's a gigantic conversation that we had. This is one thing that I've had parents do over the years, and it's been very, very successful. It's a little uncomfortable for parents at first, but it really creates a dynamic between the child and the parent that takes them well into their adult years.
Yeah.
And that is to make a commitment to every night, no matter how many children you have, every night give 15 minutes to each child in their bedroom. Or if you have kids who share bedrooms, then somewhere else in your bedroom maybe. But 15 minutes, and you give that to the child, and there's no anything you have to do.
Yeah.
And if you go into the child's room, just say, you know, I'm here, how was your day? And the child says, I don't want to talk about it. Okay.
Okay.
Take out a newspaper, sit in the room for 15 minutes with the child, who's going to be really angry that you're still there. I don't care. Stay there. 15 minutes. And when 15 minutes are up, get up. And, you know, if your child's, you know, at the age of not going to let you kiss you or hug, that's fine. You know, pat them on your shoulder or something. Just, you know, I'm here. And that's all you say is, I'm here.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be here every
just
night.
Just bump.
No. Yeah. And I'm getting right. Whatever it is, I'm going to be here every night, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be here. And if there's a night you cannot be there, you tell your child, I want to be there for you tonight, but I cannot. We're not going to have our 15 minutes tonight, but I'm coming back tomorrow.
Yes.
And you just keep doing this. And even if it's, you know, a month of going into your child's room and sitting 15 minutes, staring at them if you like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Bring a yo-yo to whatever you want. 15 minutes. 15 minutes. And get creative with this. I've had parents do the funniest things, like bring in a laser beam where they make pictures on the wall and just all sorts of things. Now, what this does is it very strongly sends a message to the child that I'm here.
You're always there.
I'm here.
Yeah.
I don't care how old you are. I don't care whether you're talking to me or not. It makes no difference because I love you. I'm here.
Yeah.
The only thing you're not allowed to do in those 15 minutes is punish, yell, criticize, or prod the child.
Yeah.
And that's what's so hard for parents. I had one mother. Oh, this is the funniest. I had one mother who just, she knew. She did this every day. And she called me in a panic. I did it. But I yelled at him for 15 minutes. Oh, my gosh. I'm killing my kid. I don't know what to do. It's like, no. It's fine. I said, do this. Go in again tomorrow night and take your mouth shut.
Ah.
And we explained how to do that so she wouldn't get hurt.
Yeah.
And she did it. And she went in, and the teenager just laughed and ended up breaking a cycle of anger between them.
Yeah. Wow.
So, and all you got to do is be there.
Well, and they need to know, too, like you just were, you know, that shows the teenager that you're aware of what you were doing and you're trying to make a change. And what a powerful lesson that is. In and of itself, to teach a teenager that, we can get in a cycle that's bad, but let's change it.
Yeah.
Wow, that's powerful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, the mother then became creative on days when she was really angry.
Yeah.
She'd go in with her mouth sign, we've called it, and she wrote, I don't want to yell, like right on the mouth. And then she'd go in and sit down.
Huh.
And it ended up that they became very close.
Yeah. Interesting.
The other thing it does is reinforces the idea that the room is not private. Now, you know, it's not private. It's private for the time the child's in there. It's not private past that.
No.
The next thing is let them get away with small things. And I battle with parents all the time on this because they feel like if they give a little bit, the child will take a yard.
Yeah.
And that's true for
sometimes. Sometimes they do. But.
But you can manage this. And again, if you do the other suggestions that I said,
you're
going to have a lot less battle with your child overall anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They're more likely to talk to you than they are to hide.
Yeah.
Here's an example of one. I know a lot of kids have TVs in their rooms. I always advocate for no TVs in the kids' room, but I'm, you know, old and fossil-like, I suppose, but I have a very good reason for that, and it's that most kids are not controlling their TV watching, and they have it on at night when they go to sleep, and that's the worst time to have it on.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Let them get away with small things. So instead of saying no TV at night, and you're battling with your child because every night he has his TV on, and you're pulling the TV out, and he has to earn it back.
Right.
That just creates a whole lot of trouble families don't need. Instead, say this. You may have it on for 30 minutes on a timer.
Yeah.
And then you need to set an alarm. You need to go up to your child's room in 30 minutes, make sure that it's off.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not, click it off.
Yeah.
I've told parents to take their kids' clickers so that they can turn it off themselves.
Okay.
and remove the clicker. So when you go in at night and say goodnight, take the clicker with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you put it sleep timer 30 minutes and then you leave.
Okay.
And,
okay.
Yeah, unlike...
But doing that with the computer, internet, anything like that mm-hmm. is giving them a time limit.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Right. Let them get away with the small things. So if they really, you know, if girls want to wear makeup, maybe help them select what makeup they can
appropriate
wear.
Appropriate makeup,
and,
that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cover up or something.
Or even appropriate clothing that they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of the midriff shirts, maybe
right.
you can come to a compromise on length of shirt that
mm-hmm.
maybe they like that's more peer oriented than what we want them
yeah.
in. You know?
And this one, the last one, is probably the most powerful. Teach them about silence. One of the biggest problems for a human being is a sense of isolation. And when we feel isolated from others, that's when we go into self-destructive behaviors, unfortunately. Or we become depressed. Or now, when I talk about isolation, I know a lot of you out there are like, oh, no, I love that. Well, I'm talking about something different. I'm talking about being separated, feeling separated from other people
yeah.
during that. The problem with adolescents is that they see silence as being isolation.
Mm-hmm. Well, they already feel isolated,
mm-hmm.
and now the silence just adds to it. I would
and
think
magnifies
it would
compound
it. Yeah, yeah,
it does. And so what happens is that in those moments, they make the dumbest decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, because they usually make decisions to not have the silence,
right.
and that's the exact time when the things come up that they need to deal
need
with.
To. Yeah.
We have an entire generation. In fact, I now read the other day in studies, we have two generations of young adults and teenagers and children who are afraid of silence.
Yeah.
They don't know how to be silent. They don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
They have iPods. They have their phones.
Mm-hmm.
They have computers. They have movies, TVs, their computer.
Yeah.
They have all kinds of things to keep them from having to be alone and quiet.
And even the texting and things like that are, it may be a silent activity, but it's not silent.
No.
They're having a conversation, so yeah,
right.
even if their room is quiet.
Right, well, it's a busy
they
head.
They might still be blah, 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 away.
Yeah, yeah, it's a busy head, and what I'm really
yeah.
talking about is not having the busy head,
yeah.
but learning to have a still head. It's in those still moments that all of what we need to deal with in our lives comes. We also weren't raised with iPods and all those things. Yeah, and teenagers don't know what to do with it a lot of times.
No.
And they get scared because of what comes up during it. So one of the things to do is to teach silence by walking with them in silence. So
oh, yeah.
one of the things that I recommend to families is to take walks,
mm-hmm.
but to tell each other that you have to do it in silence. So you want to go somewhere not in public,
yeah.
but, you know, go to wherever your family likes to go. If you don't have a place, find one.
I bet you there's nature preserves almost anywhere in the world. There's, you know, we're preserving land. And
mm-hmm.
You know, I have two within 10 minutes of my house that
mm-hmm.
we go to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even in big cities, most of them have gigantic parks.
Something park or something. Yeah.
And so take quiet walks together and just agree to be quiet for 5, 10, 15 minutes and not
yeah.
talk and just be and walk. The other thing is to just do yard work. If you have your child doing yard work, a lot of them will do chores around the house with their iPods on or whatever they're listening to, or they'll turn on the radio. Have them do it in quiet.
Yeah. I found in my classroom sometimes I would put up a do not disturb sign, and they used to think it was funny. I'd put it on my head.
Yeah.
Because my head would be down. I'd say, okay, I'm going to grade papers for 10 minutes or a lesson plan or something. You all work. Don't ask me questions. Nobody's going to the bathroom. And I would put it on my head. So that's all they saw when they looked up at me. And they laugh, you
yeah.
know, but the point being is you don't need me for 10 minutes. You're all good with your thoughts for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Silence is very powerful. Now, a lot of adults have gotten out of the habit of being in silence too, but teenagers, something very magical happens in that silence. That is the time when their self solidifies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the time when they have thoughts about comparing their sense of self to their parents, to what their peers say,
right.
to what their teachers say. But finally,
mm-hmm.
once they get to be about 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, they have their own sense of self. And it really happens around 16, 17, 18, more
right.
like 17, 18, where they finally have a firmer sense of self
yeah.
that they then compare to how everyone else sees them.
Right.
The whole idea behind Erikson's theory of psychosocial development, and in particular this stage, is that self-identity has to be so solid that you are yourself no matter where you are, and you're not carrying different selves to each place. That is a sign of maturity.
Wow.
And it's a sign of working through this particular ego crisis of the stage.
Right.
So, wow, we've really covered a lot today. I think that if you could keep sending in your questions, that we'll be very happy to answer them, because clearly they're giving us enough for entire podcast episodes.
Absolutely. So that address is 411child@gmail.com if you want to send us a question.
And within the next week or so, we should have our 411child.com website finished. Right now, it'll just take you to our business website.
Which is good,
okay.
Too. Go look at that.
Yeah. So thanks so much for joining us today, and we're going to be back probably next week with, get this, part 3 of adolescence.
It goes on.
Where we're going to talk about very specific issues, including teenage suicide and drug use and probably sex activity. So that's what we'll talk about next time.
Excellent.
Thank you for joining us.